This is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. This show focuses on the moments that transform our lives, the moments that upend our preconceived notions of how to live, of who we are, of how we make sense of our world. And over the past year, we've told stories of people from all walks of life and from all over the world. But mostly, we've told the stories of New Yorkers, the city that never stops changing, often morphing into something right before our eyes, the birthplace of arrivals. The East Village of today was the Lower East Side of 1982. And where high rises now crowd the East River in Williamsburg, 10 years ago, there were none. On the one-year anniversary of this show, we go back to a grittier period in New York's history, when Lower Manhattan was filled with shooting galleries instead of art galleries, the public and project housing that was invaded by the crack epidemic of the early 1980s. It's in this environment that two young men from very different backgrounds became friends. And it's here, on New Year's Day long ago, that one moment would transform both of their lives forever.
My name is Jerry McGill, and I'm a writer. I grew up in New York City. I was born in Brooklyn, in Brownsville, Brooklyn, where Mike Tyson is our most famous resident. And then when I was 6 years old, we had to move to Manhattan. And so I spent a lot of time on the Lower East Side, which is now referred to as the East Village. But back then, we called it the Lower East Side. So at that time, the Lower East Side was a very dangerous place. It was kind of a joke, which is I grew up on Avenue D. And the joke was you never go past Avenue A unless you needed drugs or you were in a gang. You wanted crack. Crack was really at its prime use, and it was very common to have like a violent act in our neighborhood. It was a very kind of dirty, kind of impoverished neighborhood. I lived in a tenement where the elevators were often broken. It was graffiti strewn. It was a very dangerous place where I grew up.
I'm Dalton Conley, and I'm from New York City, specifically the Lower East Side, even more specifically Avenue D and Houston Street. I was born in 1969, and my parents moved to the Lower East Side at that time because they were artists. My mom is a novelist and my father's a painter, and they had no money, and it was affordable. Still on the East Coast, I think public housing at that point, Mitchell-Lama housing, all these sort of subsidized programs were seen as a place of hope. You know, it was long after the kind of peak of black migration from the South, but it was still a period of high migration from Puerto Rico, for example. It was a very Puerto Rican neighborhood at that time. So a lot of people ask me, why did your parents, who were white, and they weren't economically middle class, but they were certainly culturally middle class and educationally middle class at that time. Why the hell did they raise you there? Like, how selfish could they be? So it was just a mess that I don't think my parents knew they were getting themselves into. And it's like the proverbial frog, that if you drop the frog in boiling water, the frog will jump out. But if you turn the heat up slowly on the frog, frog doesn't have a reflexive reaction to jump out of the water and will be boiled alive. So I think they were kind of boiled alive and not realizing how bad things were going to get.
Growing up in a neighborhood did have a lot of effects on me. I saw violence at a young age. I saw a man get killed once. I feel like it caused me to grow up very quickly because, you know, you're around a lot of dark scenes, and it made me very much aware of my surroundings, and I was accustomed to seeing ugly things at a young age. I think it caused me to grow up a lot quicker.
So they didn't really actually fit in with the 60s culture. They were a little bit older for, you know, they weren't, you know, 18-year-old draft dodgers in 1969. They were, you know, 30 by then. So my mother looked like a hippie, but she doesn't even drink. She doesn't, you know, smoke pot. She's kind of a nerd, but she's got the frizzy hair and, like, she had the flower print dresses of the hippie era. My dad couldn't stand hippies and kind of modeled himself more after the jazz age, the sort of post-war bebop jazz age, and the abstract expressionist painters, kind of machismo of Jackson Pollock or William de Kooning that went along with that. So it was bohemian, but it was not flower child by any means.
As a kid, school was kind of difficult for me, especially grade school. I remember, I think, now that I look back on it, and now that I've been a teacher myself, if I was looking at myself as a student, I think I had a very low attention span. I wouldn't say I was ADD at all, because I think that's an overused term, but I will say that I had a low attention span, and I also just wasn't interested in school. Like, I think the things that we were being taught wasn't very interesting to me.
We weren't the only white family living in this area, but we were certainly one of the few. I didn't know that skin color was the way we divided up families back then. When I was three, I was impatient waiting for my baby sister to be born, so I kidnapped one in the playground and proudly pushed a stroller over to my mom and jammed it into her shins as she was sitting on the splintered green bench. And how did I know that actually this, you know, chocolate colored little girl in a stroller couldn't be my biological sister, at least, or that would be pretty rare. I didn't know that we divided families up that way. You know, the difference between big and little, or even by then boy and girl, was much more salient to me than the notion that skin color was a very critical dividing line in our society. It's probably more seamless because people are living among people of the same color or same race, and encounters are either seen on TV or they're read in a book. And I think that in my case, they were very present and lived experiences.
It was New Year's Day in 1982, and I had a few friends who lived in Greenwich Village, who actually lived in a very nice area of Greenwich Village. Like, they lived in a posh area. Their parents were artists. And I had been staying with them, me and three of my best friends. We had been staying with my friend who lived there for a few days. And then finally his mother said, "Hey, you guys, you know, you've been here a few days, you gotta go home." And she said one of us could stay, but two of us had to go. And so we kind of did the whole choosing thing. And me and my best friend, Eric, had to go home. And it was already like around 11 o'clock when we decided to leave to head back to the Lower East Side. Eric lived on the Lower East Side too.
My father and I took karate lessons from someone he met in the local area when he was working out in the kind of concrete and littered glass Hamilton Fish Park right behind our house. And he was Rahim, a black Muslim sensei. We went to this Brooklyn mosque for tournaments, and Muslim prayer was incorporated into the whole ritual, so I thought that was part of karate. I didn't learn enough to like actually defend myself, and I would never have you know, been effective if I was trying to fight someone off with a gun or a knife or something in my neighborhood. He was shot and killed. That was sort of the first wake-up call for my parents, I think, that they were in an area or in a situation that they didn't have total control of, and you know, the stakes were pretty high when someone you know pretty well gets shot to death on the street.
So we started going home, and we stopped off actually to play video games at this kind of late night pizza parlor that we frequented. And that, of course, took us to about midnight. So by the time we really got back to the Lower East Side, it was around midnight. And I remember we stopped off at Eric's place, and I was saying goodbye to him right out on his stoop. And it was midnight, you know, roughly. But again, it was something I was accustomed to doing. We did this a lot. Like, I came home late a lot. And just never really worried about it. I got in trouble for it when I got home, but I did it often. And suddenly a loud bang rang out, and I remember having this sensation of like falling slowly, like it felt like I was falling in slow motion to the floor, to the ground. And I remember Eric thinking I was joking at first, and he was saying, hey, come on, get up. And I remember I could barely speak. And I remember feeling numb. And then Eric suddenly realized that I wasn't joking because he saw blood like on the back of my coat. I remember knowing right away that I had been shot. I remember hearing the loud bang and knowing how I felt. I put two and two together right away. And then in the ambulance, they told me what happened to as we were going to the hospital. You know, got to the ER where I was told that I'd been shot but that I would live. I remember my mother showing up about an hour or two later. And just like holding my hand and letting me know I was gonna be okay.
One of my friends who grew up with me in the neighborhood, he was hanging out on January 1st and got shot for a ricochet bullet in our neighborhood, and it hit him in the neck, and he was paralyzed. Quadriplegic, and you know, after Raheem being killed, my mom already wanted to leave, and this was like the case was closed at that point. You know, Jerome just got shot. We're moving, and so we moved.
For the first month or so, I really didn't know how serious it was. I didn't know anybody who was paralyzed. I didn't know anybody who'd ever been shot. I really thought that, hey, after a little while, the doctors will patch me up and I'll go home and live a normal life again and I'll be fine. But after a while of having physical therapy and occupational therapy, I was beginning to notice that I wasn't getting any better. And I also remember having a conversation with my nurse where I kind of joked with her, but I was kind of serious too about how I can't wait to leave the hospital and go back to roller skating, something I was very fond of as well. And she, I remember her asking me, hey, you think you're going to leave here and go roller skating? And I said, yeah. And then it was, you know, I think a day or two later where my doctor came to me and said to me, hey, I have to have a serious conversation with you. And he let me know that I was going to be paralyzed for life. I wound up having to go to a new school for young people with disabilities because my old school wasn't wheelchair accessible either. So I made a whole bunch of new friends in this school, and then I moved on to a high school and made a whole bunch of new friends there. But the sad truth is I lost a lot of my good friendships after my shooting.
So when I moved to the white side of town, I felt discombobulated. These were supposedly, quote unquote, my people that I finally was hanging out with, but I felt more disconnected from them than I did from my neighbors growing up. It was all played out through this lens of race and of moving right when I was going to high school. So I felt like the last 4 years of my childhood, high school basically, was limbo. Like, I didn't really know anybody in my new neighborhood. I kind of treated it like a bed and breakfast. I came in, I did my homework, I went to sleep, I went to school. My friends were school-based. I didn't have any friends in the neighborhood. So I didn't really take to it. And I was like a ghost floating through the hallways.
At first, though, I gotta say, I remember early on after my shooting, I would have these kind of fantasies, like if I ever caught the person who did this to me, I would do this to them, like I would torture them, or I would bring them a lot of pain, and I would want to see them jailed, and I had this kind of sense that I wanted revenge. But that kind of dissipated very quickly, especially once I realized that, A, they would never catch this person, and B, I realized that it wasn't really going to get me anywhere, because the reality was I was in this position. You could send someone to jail for the rest of their life, what they did to me. It wasn't going to change how I was. And I just spent all my energy becoming a better person. I think I just said, hey, you know, this happened, but I'm going to move forward. I've still got a lot of things, positive things that can happen.
I don't think I really started making sense of my own narrative until I went to graduate school, sociology. I didn't study sociology as an undergrad. I took one class. I barely remembered it. And I think many academics, at least me, were guided by some unconscious need to figure something out. I don't know how that works for like a math professor, but it certainly worked for me that I think over time I was unconsciously drawn to social sciences to figure out the issues that as a little kid I couldn't really make sense of around me.
I refused to go back for a long time just because I didn't see what the usefulness of it would be. But once I realized I wanted to write this book, I thought, hey, if you're going to write this book, you really need to go back and see like what that was, where it was. You need to go back and see what the neighborhood is like now. I just thought it would be a wonderful starting point. So I actually took my friend Dalton Connolly. He came with me and we went back to the neighborhood where we went back to the exact block where it happened and the exact spot where I was shot.
I have watched as my beloved native city has really transformed over the last 20 to 30 years. I used to feel like growing up, we were on a different planet than the rest of the United States. I think the rest of the United States would have been happy if we were on a different planet. You know, it was the days of Ford to City, drop dead, financial crisis, blackouts, garbage strikes, crime, horrible. But there was something so gritty and unique to it that you almost felt like a war veteran. You felt this sort of brotherhood of having survived or continuing to survive in it. Today, I feel like New York is not that different from the rest of the, it's getting more and more like the rest of the country, which depresses me a little bit.
And funny enough, now it's a totally different neighborhood. Like gentrification has taken over, and that neighborhood is now, it's like I said, they call it the West Village now. The East Village now. And it really is like NYU has taken over. NYU student housing everywhere. There's like a beer steins here and there. It's just a whole new place. It's a place where everyone feels safe. And
back then, I would have been thrilled if it were more. There wasn't Applebee's back then, but you know, there wasn't Red Lobster back then. But there were, you know, there was, I think, like 3 McDonald's in all of Manhattan. I remember one was on 15th Street and 6th Avenue. There was no, White Castle was like an exotic thing to us. Kentucky Fried Chicken, an exotic thing. You know, there was not, as there was fast food all over the country, as a kid, we didn't have it here. And it was so, it was something that we craved, we wanted. It was such a thrill if we were outside the city to be able to go to, you know, one of these places.
You would never in your life know that it was once a neighborhood full of like hollowed out crack dens and stuff. But I went back and I have to say it felt really, there wasn't a relief. It wasn't like I got any kind of big weight off my back. It was just like, okay, I did this. Nice. And it gave me a great starting point. I took pictures of the neighborhood and stuff, and there wasn't any real sense of release or anything. It was just like, okay, I did it. Now I can move on.
So now you can't walk down the street without seeing, a Starbucks and then this store and that store, and there's TGI Fridays in Manhattan, and there's Red Lobster, and there's all these things that were, to me, when I was a kid, like exotic Americana. And now, then there's like sports fields, which is great for raising kids, like at Chelsea Piers, but it seems very sort of mainstream, like recreating the suburbs here. It's hard to argue that like the good old days when there was 2,000 murders is we should go back to that, but it definitely feels like it's lost something as well.
People will ask me, they'll have friends. Whenever I meet a new friend, they'll want to know what happened to me, and they'll come up to me, and they'll be all shy about it, and they'll be kind of concerned about my feelings, and they'll say, hey, I hope you don't mind, but just like, what happened to put you in a wheelchair? And I say, I don't mind at all, and I tell them, and it's like rolls off my back. But they worry that they're going to put me back in some traumatic place, but it's really not a very big deal. I can tell the story with such ease because I've come out, and I've come through it, and come through it very well.
My deepest thanks to Jerry McGill and Dalton Connolly for sharing their stories. Jerry and Dalton have both written extensively about this period in their lives, so really, if you want to know more about them, read their books. Jerry's book is entitled Dear Marcus, A Letter to the Man Who Shot Me, and Dalton's is entitled Honky, and you can find links to both of them on our website. This episode could not have been made without the help of Emma Jacobs, who co-produced and edited the program with me. And many thanks as well to Nora Lind for her production assistance. Arrivals is written, produced, and recorded all over the world, in the lovely East Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, along the mighty Willamette in Portland, in London, and underneath the bright and brilliant skies of El Paso, Texas. It has been a year. The best year of my life. One full year since I dreamed up this show and you decided to listen. And I cannot thank you enough. Your ears mean everything to me. And it's what keeps this program a living, breathing thing. So drop me a line. I want to know what you think of the show, what you'd like to hear more of, less of, your own arrival stories, all of it. Email me at arrivalsshow@gmail.com. However you spell it, I'll get it. And leave us a review on iTunes. It really does help us spread the word. And we're hosting live shows all over the country this year. San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, Chicago. If you'd like to participate, or if you think we should bring stories of migration, transformation, and change to your town, let us know. And there are tons of ways that you can link up with us. Via Instagram, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and at our website, ARRVLS.com. We release a microcast of Arrival stories, with outtakes and other ephemera from the Arrivals podcast, which you can find there as well. This concludes our second season, with a new season of Arrival stories from across the globe only a few weeks away. It's going to be a banner year for the show, so please stay tuned. And in the meantime, check out all of the shows on The Herd, the audio collective that Arrivals is a proud and founding member of. 6 independent shows from 6 independent makers all over North America who have banded together to share resources and to promote one another's work. Our fearless leader and founder is Jacob Lewis, the host of Neighbors, the show where next door hits home. And his most recent episode is incredible. I'm terrified of clowns, and yet this story moved me to tears. Enough said. Check out Neighbors and all the other Herd shows at theherdradio.com. That's HEARD radio.com. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.
I'm Adam from Acast. You may have heard from me before. I like to use big words. Words like denizen or antithesis. For better words and more engaging voices, together with our personally curated lists of suggested podcast episodes, do check out our app. Acast is available in all good app stores and from acast.com.